Over here?
I think so.
Oh, okay.
I think so.
Okay.
Unless it's subject to change, but...
Well, we'd be lucky to get there at all.
I didn't know what was best, whether you came here or I came over there early on Friday.
Right. Either way, works out for me.
All right. Well, we'll talk about it tomorrow then.
Okay, that sounds good.
Just to make sure we know what we're doing.
That sounds good. Actually, Friday works better for me, but Thursday's good too, so.
All right. Okay. I'll try and communicate with Dan too. I'll send an email out tonight and just we'll communicate.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right.
On that note, we're going to continue our study in the book of Mark. And I wanted to look at a verse in Mark chapter 9. And I wanted to look here at verse 19. Okay, Mark 9, verse 19. Okay. And Mark records this. O unbelieving generation, replied Jesus, how long must I be with you? How long must I have patience with you? Bring the boy to me. Now, in reference to a boy who's been possessed by a demon, and the Lord is referencing some things, talking to this man who has brought his child to him to have the demon exorcised out of him. But I think it's really interesting because I wanted to look at the two questions that Jesus asks. The first one is, how long must I be with you? And the second one is, how long must I have patience with you? Now, it's interesting because the first question is rather rhetorical, and it expresses some frustration that he has, that his presence with them has not resulted in greater faith. And this miracle is going to be all about faith. And in fact, at the end of it, towards the end of it, the father is going to say, I believe, but help my unbelief. So faith is an issue in the equation. The second question reveals the heavy load that their unbelief placed on him. So the first question is directly pointed at them, and it expresses his frustration that their faith isn't progressing. The second question is the heavy burden that their unbelief places on him. And I wanna look at these two things from the point of view of Jesus as the servant. Because Mark is the book about Jesus in his service and as the servant of man. And I think it's oftentimes we look at scripture and I think we approach it many times with misconceptions. I really believe that. And I think we do it honestly. Part of it is we're approaching it and we're looking at it 2,000 years removed from an event. Mm-hmm. It's a different culture. It was a different society. Even if it was a Western culture, the society would have been radically different 2,000 years ago than it is today.
Nothing is like
today is a unique time.
By the way, did you happen to see killing Jesus? No.
I did not.
They have this miracle like this. You don't even know what it is because it's so nondescript.
Right.
You know, they just take so much liberty with the script and all that.
Sure.
There's a boy there with his eyes rolled back and foaming at the mouth and all
right.
That. Very similar to this. Almost the Lord that brings him in.
Okay.
And just the look, surprised look on Jesus' face when the child comes back to life. Miracle in the depiction in the movie.
Right.
It looks like the child is dying because Jesus was there.
Right.
You know, and it's like, it never says that anywhere.
No.
Where did you get that from?
Yeah. Well, movies take a lot of liberties.
Oh, man.
But he's not specifically talking about this one person. He's generalizing.
It's
saying,
general.
And this is an example of how you all are.
That's correct. There's a crowd that's there, and he's speaking. In particular, it's really pointed at his disciples, first and foremost.
We didn't really read the context.
We didn't read the context because I want to go back and I want to look at some things, and we'll come to the context. But I wanted to show first and foremost as servant just how alone Jesus was.
Okay.
I want to focus on that first and foremost. And then and the reason he's alone is because of the lack of faith of those that surround him. I want to begin it from the very beginning point. And the very beginning point is his family. You know, obviously Jesus came into this world as a child, as an infant. And being an infant, he had a mother that cared for him. And he had a stepfather, I'll use that term, you know, that cared for him. And he had brothers and he had sisters. And we oftentimes don't think of that. I know Hollywood has a movie coming out now where they're trying to portray what his early life was like. Well, the scriptures really don't tell us a lot. But it does tell us a few things. Like at the age of 12, for instance, we know that he goes into the temple and he teaches in the temple and his parents are looking for him. And he asks them, well, why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I'd be about my father's business? So it tells us some things about Jesus at the age of 12. But there's some things that are said about his family, that we can gather some information from those things about what his life would be like. So if you go back to chapter number 3 for a second. Mark chapter 3. And in another hand, if you could take Matthew chapter 12. Mark 3 and Matthew 12. Okay. In Mark chapter 3, just so you get the context of what's taking place. Let's look here at verse 13 in Mark 3. And it says, then he, speaking of Jesus, went up the hill, and those whom he himself selected, he summoned, and they came to him. Now, Luke adds for us in his account, then he went up to pray, okay, because what he's doing is he's going to be choosing the 12 apostles, okay, and Luke is the only one of the gospel accounts or the evangel accounts that mentions the fact that he went to pray when he went up to the hill. Here, Mark just records that he went up the hill. It says, verse 14, he appointed 12 of them that they might be with him and that he might also apostolize them to broadcast, and to have power to cure sickness and to expel demons. So he's commissioning these 12 individuals to go out and to be able to do some things. They're his inner circle now. And if you want to look at it this way, Jesus is presenting himself as the Messiah to Israel. And he's choosing his inner cabinet of his government. You could think of it like that. It's in this context that we read verse 20. And he went into a house. But again, the crowd assembled so that there was no opportunity for them even to snatch a meal. That tells you how busy he is. Verse 21. And when his family heard this, they set out to restrain him, for they said, he is out of his mind. Now, it could actually be translated and be very accurate, for he is insane.
Mm-hmm. Mine says he is unbalanced.
Unbalanced. The word restrain there has the idea of arrest. And you have to understand, mental patients back in those days would be arrested and held in like a jail environment. They didn't know anything about mental illnesses back then. But his family literally thought he was insane.
Why did they think he was insane? Why?
Well, he's going about calling himself the Messiah and choosing an inner circle, and he's appointing them to be able to go out and heal and exorcise demons and all of those things. They think he's went around the deep end and back. That's not a family that's supporting his ministry.
Now, this says friends and his friends, not family.
Right.
Why did they interpret this as friends?
Verse 21. The reason it's interpreted that way, and you have to understand, they don't want to cast any of his family, in particular his mother, in a bad light. But it should be rendered as family, especially in light of verse 31. By this time, his mother and his brothers arrive, and standing outside, they send a message to summoning him. So you have this idea that they set out to restrain him in verse 21. Verse 31, they've arrived. So you have to kind of follow that idea here.
Well, then this is a cumulative from when he was 12 years old, and they lost him, mm-hmm. and he's telling them, what are you looking for me
they
for?
They think he's insane, but
I mean, he started when he was a kid.
It started when he was a kid. That's my whole point. I'm even going to go back further with it. We look at something in Luke. But the whole point is, they are not convinced that he's anything like what he says he is. They think he's crazy. In Matthew, if you want to go to Matthew chapter 12, Matthew's going to recount this. Now, in the Matthew account, he has, chapter 12 is a really important dissertation that Mark leaves out. Mark doesn't get into this discussion that Matthew spends an entire chapter talking about. And in chapter 12, that's really the chapter where you have a threefold rejection of Christ's three offices of prophet, priest, and king. He's going to be rejected, and you have different people or things representing each one. Solomon, for instance, representing the office of king. The temple representing the office of priest. And Jonah representing the office of the prophet. But you have that account given. The other thing that's interesting, in chapter number 3 of Mark, we're going to be in Matthew 12. In chapter number 3, you just have a lot of nonstop action in Mark, where Matthew has this long discourse. So that's one of the distinctives of Mark, is that flow of action, where Matthew's distinctiveness is those long discourses that you'll read. But here in Matthew chapter 12, you have verse 46. Actually, let's go up a little further. Verse 43, let's start there. We'll go 43 down through 50. Maybe we can kind of read around. I'll start with 43. When an unclean spirit goes out of a person, it passes through waterless places, looking for rest, but does not find it.
Then he says, I will return to my house from which I came out, and coming, he finds it standing empty, swept, and decorated.
Then he goes and brings back with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself. They come in and dwell there. In the end, that man's condition becomes worse than it was at first. So will it be the same way with the present wicked generation.
While he had talked to the people, behold, his mother and his brethren stood without, desiring to speak with him. Then one said to him, behold, your mother and your brethren stand without, desiring to speak with you.
Who is my mother? He replied to the man. And who are my brothers?
And stretching out his hand over his disciples, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers.
To be obeying my Father, who is in the heavens, that is to be my brother and my sister and my mother.
Okay, so it's interesting. This account here in Matthew is where Mark ends up finishing, is with that recount. They're outside. And then you have the discussion in Mark, which will read similar to Matthew. The difference is, though, that we have the idea of a conversation that entailed before Jesus makes the statement, well, who are my mothers, and so forth. And what he's talking about is this idea of an unclean spirit. But what preceded that was a threefold rejection of him. You have in verse 42 the rejection of him as a king, where he compares it with Solomon. You have in verse 40 and 41 the rejection of him as a prophet, using Jonah is the example there. And then you have the idea of the temple earlier on in the chapter, where he's using that in reference to the idea of him is a priest. So they've rejected his threefold ministry with the temple. Yep. He then talks about, because one of the things he's done is he's cast these unclean or demonic spirits out of people, and he says they go through waterless places, which is interesting. There's a lot on that to think about, looking for rest, but they don't find it. Then he goes, they get this brilliant idea after they've been cast out, well, I'll go back to where I once was. And they find it empty because the person hasn't put anything in there to replace what was expelled. So they don't have faith.
Is that a waterless place?
Well, again,
the person.
The person's solid.
Right, wait.
Yeah, they're solid.
Solid. Mostly
water, but we do have solid.
The earth is represented by water.
Right.
If we're a waterless place, that's the first time I ever thought of that,
right,
as graphic as that is.
Right.
Be without a spirit.
Right.
Without spirit.
I think
otherwise we'd have to say that, well, they like to hang around the desert. Well, do they or don't they?
I think it's a reference to exactly that, a spirit. They are looking for a person that doesn't have the Spirit of God within him.
It would be the ultimate irony, though, that he went to the gathering and he cast out the gathering demoniacs.
Right.
The legion.
Right.
And they ran into the pigs, and the pigs went right down and got choked
to the water. Pigs. Yep.
Just exactly where they didn't want to go.
Right.
But they got carried there by pigs.
Right. Right. There's a lot there, and maybe at some point we'll look at that. But the whole point is they go back, they decide to go back, they see it's still empty because they haven't replaced that spirit with the Spirit of God. It's empty, it's devoid. And it's decorated and swept clean, right? So he goes back with seven other spirits that are all more wicked than the previous one, and the person's final condition is worse than his prior condition. Now, it's at this point that his mother and brothers are outside the house wanting to speak to him because they think he's went around the loony bin. And what he's saying is, really a repudiation of his family. He's saying my real family isn't necessarily those that are related to me by flesh and blood. My real family are those who are obeying my father. That's who my real family is. Oh yeah. They definitely are hearing this. He's rebuking them for their unbelief. And I think that's really something that a lot of people try to argue around that schematic. But he really is rebuking them. If you go with me, let's look at the Luke account for a second. In Luke, let's go to Luke 8.
How does the house, so to speak, which is a metaphor for the individual, I assume, get swept and decorated?
Well, again, he's just talked. He's recapping what his ministry has been up to that point in Matthew 12.
He's there.
And what he's done is his presence has cast out demons out of people, and it's cleaned that individual
so
up.
Referring to Israel as the house.
That's correct.
The house of Israel, the nation.
That's correct.
And when he leaves.
When he leaves, they're just going to be worse than they were.
They're going to be worse.
Yeah. Now, if you go back to Luke.
Unless.
Unless they replace that spirit with the spirit.
Yeah. And the apostles are being listened to.
Mm-hmm. Now, in Luke. Luke's account occurs after the parable of the sower and the seed, and after the parable of the lampstand. Okay, you know, putting a lamp under a bushel. Okay, it's at that point that Luke records this event with his mother and brothers and sisters. So, in verse 16, Luke 8. Verse 16, now no one lights a lamp to hide it under a vessel or under a bed, but sets it on a stand to give light to all the company. Whatever is now obscure shall hereafter be made clear. Whatever is now concealed shall then be publicly known. So take care how you listen, for he who has, to him shall more be given. Well, as for him who has not, from him shall be taken even what he thinks he has. Then came to him his mother and his brothers, but could not get near him for the crowd. So he was told, your mother and your brothers are standing outside, wanting to see you. But he replied to them, my mother and my brother are those who hear the word of Elohim and do it.
I mean, now that you think about it, wouldn't you think she'd want to hear that?
Well, I'm going to look at some things said about Mary right around the time of the birth of Christ that we think of in a certain way, but Scripture doesn't back that idea. Okay? Because unfortunately, we have to understand most of us to some degree have been influenced in some way, shape, or form by Roman Catholicism. In some doctrine, somewhere, we have been influenced by it. And one of the areas where Christianity has really been influenced by Roman Catholicism is the idea that Mary was always this believer. She wasn't. And she was not a believer at this point in time. The Lord's outright rebuking her and taking her to task.
With the miracle that happened with her, oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm. That's why I want to look at
she's the only one that this ever happened to.
Let's go to Luke 2. This is a passage a lot of people look at, and they all have this really nice, warm, fuzzy idea about what it's saying,
but it's not saying what they want it to say.
Right.
okay. I mean, we all think of that Magnificat that Mary gives, and we think of that, but there's other things, too, that are there. Luke chapter 2 and verse 19. Somebody could read this.
Mary treasured up all these words, pondering in her heart what they might mean.
Okay, what they might mean isn't part of the text. It's italicized. Okay, the computer felt that that was needed for the understanding. And I want to look at the word pondering for a minute. Okay. What does that word mean to you?
Consider.
To mull over.
To think deeply, to mull over.
Meditate.
To meditate. It actually comes from the Greek word sumbalo. S-U-M-B-A-L-L-O. It's actually sumbalo.
It's a balo word.
Yeah.
Parabalo.
Yeah. Yeah. It has a number of different ways it could be understood, and I wanna give you one of those. The way it's translated in the Book of Acts, chapter 17, and verse 18. Okay. Acts chapter 17 and verse 18. I'm reading it out of the Concordance, but I don't think the Concordance translates it very well either. Somebody can read it out of King James then too, but I know the King James doesn't translate it real well either. Let me read it here first though. Now some of the Epicurean as well as Stoic philosophers parlayed, that's the word, with him. And some said, whatever may this rook be wanting to say, yet others he seems to be an announcer of strange demons, seeing that he brought them the evangel of Jesus in the resurrection.
Epicurean.
Thank you. Okay. Epicureans. There you go. But it was the word parlayed in the Concordance.
Yeah, it here doesn't mean encountered.
Yep. Encountered. Do you want to just read it so the folks in Ohio can?
Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. Some said, what will this backward say? Others, some, he seems to be a better force of strange guides because he preached us them Jesus and the resurrection.
Okay. Thomas, or Joseph Thayer, says of the word, it should be understood to fight with one or to fight with another. To confront, to be in a dispute. And that's Thayer's understanding of it. In fact, that's also one of the definitions that's given by Strong's in the Strong's Concordance, to fight with or to fight against something. Let's look at it with that understanding. But Mary treasured up all these words, fighting it in her heart. And I think that comes closer to the meaning because as we progress, it's very clear she doesn't fully understand what happened to her. She's treasuring these things because it's the birth of her son.
Well, to treasure up something can also give the implication that you're burying them.
Burying. Yeah.
You're not burying.
Burying.
Yeah, like a treasure box. You're suppressing it. You're hiding it. You're not opening up and letting everyone know what has transpired to you.
Right.
Everyone else is assuming that this woman had committed some kind of fornication or adultery. And Joseph, being a just man, decides to marry her instead of putting her away.
Right.
He's saying, what's happening here?
Right.
What's going on? He didn't understand it.
She didn't know at the moment. She understood that Gabriel came to her and announced this thing. But
the meeting
all of a sudden, it's gone. And then these things are transpiring, and she's probably young, what, 16?
If they are. She could have even been as young as 14. So,
well, she knows what she signed on for, what she gave the Magnificat. She just didn't see this stuff done.
Well,
the doctrines that he was preaching.
She gives the Magnificat, but does she really understand the impact of what she herself is even saying?
Nobody knows. Nobody.
I don't think she even did.
Had Daniel been there, he'd have been. Right. He wouldn't even know everything about
what. Or some of the other prophets,
right.
But still,
right.
Very few.
Right. The whole point is.
Simeon, he wrote two letters.
The whole point is, we've always had this idea that Jesus, when he was growing up, he had the support of a mother who understood that he was to be Israel's Messiah. And my point is,
and a father,
but we know Joseph isn't really mentioned after the temple, when Jesus is at the temple as a 12-year-old. So odds are Joseph probably had died. He probably was significantly older than Mary. Again, we don't know. That's just understanding the culture and the fact that typically older men would marry younger women back then. But again, that's an assumption. We don't know that outright. We know that he's not referenced after that we can say, for whatever reason.
Well, they weren't even numbered among the adults until they were, in some cases, 30. But he may have been 30 when he took Mary as his wife.
He could have been even older.
Yeah, the arrangement of a marriage could have taken place, and he had to wait until she was of age, too.
Right. Which could be anywhere from 12 to 14. So, you know, but the whole point I want to get at here is that we always have this assumption that as Jesus was growing up, that his family was a place that nurtured him, and yes, they did nurture him and care for him
as far as they could.
But they didn't nurture him in the sense of adding spiritual things to him.
No.
They didn't nurture him by trying to explain, hey, you're the Messiah, and encouraging him in those things. In fact, they did the opposite. They worked against him when it came to those things, including Mary. Now, later on, we see Mary at the crucifixion, but again, we don't read that she's necessarily a believer there. It's a mother who understands this is the last time she's going to see her son. I don't.
When Jesus was like 12 and was in the temple, Joseph was still living.
He was still living there.
But I mean, if Jesus was able to see at the temple, couldn't Joseph have been at the temple as well?
He could have been, but he wasn't.
But it doesn't seem like he was.
He wasn't.
They left him behind. He was trying to go home. The feast was over. He was trying to go home. And Jesus.
No, but I mean, to talk about this. Kinds of things that Jesus talked about, because it says you don't ever hear that Joseph was there. And
Joseph was blue collar.
Yeah, I know.
Jesus was with a bunch of white collar guys.
Yeah, but for whatever reason, we don't read of Joseph in any way, shape, or form other than
being
the fact that he's
there.
A just man. It's
a no record of for a lot of life. And Mary was a just woman.
Right.
She just wasn't really highly spiritual.
No.
Paul talks about going from faith to faith.
That's correct.
They had a lovely, well-grounded faith.
Sure.
It's so much as they knew. But all they knew was what they were taught by the Pharisees or the teachers in the temple of
right.
Atlanta.
And that's it. And there's a lot of error in their thinking. And that's the point. Now, with Mary, even at the point of when Jesus is being crucified, we tend to think that she's there as a believer, but she She may have been, she may not have been at that point, but there's nothing that says outright. We're told that she was there, but there were a lot of other women who were there who followed Jesus.
Yeah.
Those are believers. We know they are. Well, Mary Magdalene being first and foremost of them.
He felt it necessary to quote the 22nd Psalm,
mm-hmm.
to encapsulize what was going on at that. What were they saying?
Right.
And apparently that 22nd Psalm was a great comfort to them, but they never put it together before.
They didn't. They didn't. In my thinking, from what I read in the scriptures, I really don't think Mary became sold out that Jesus was the Messiah until after the resurrection, which is the same point when the disciples became sold out on it. Because remember, he had given them all kinds of information. And I could read at least a half a dozen different verses where he explains to them as clear as you can explain something.
They don't understand.
They refuse to believe it.
They're not going to like what I'm going to say next.
Okay. Go ahead.
They could not have been saved at all because they had no gospel. They had the gospel Jesus was preaching, which was it a salvation gospel? Yeah. But it lacked the fact of his own resurrection, his own crucifixion, for that matter. And our gospel is that he died for us, according to scriptures, he was buried. And then he rose again the third day, according to the scriptures. That power of God's salvation, they didn't have that until he died.
Well,
how else did they be saved?
That's right.
For Peter's gospel, which is like, oh, that's a weird gospel.
Well, again, the Israelites who had salvation responded in faith to what it was that God was doing in that dispensation.
Sure.
So that would be that saving message to them.
How far could that take them, really?
To salvation.
Yeah, we plan to be baptized.
That was salvation to them. And they had that.
Okay, but their salvation is different from ours in that they had the indwelling Holy Spirit very temporarily. Whereas we have him.
He could come in and leave as he so chose without
what condition were they in when he left.
Right. Well, we know again at the crucifixion that they all flee. The only one who's at the crucifixion is John. We could argue it's a family member who's at an event where he's seeing a family member die. Of course, his brother's not there. You know,
James.
So that says some things about John. But it's interesting because even after they see the tomb empty, they don't believe until they actually see him. That's when they believe. And then when they tell Thomas, he doesn't believe until he can literally put his hand into the wounds. So
he did that one thing though, didn't he?
Well, he did at that point, but the whole point is throughout his ministry, there were things about him that people believed and responded to, but throughout his ministry, even though they were responding, they really only had a little flicker of what it was he was trying to impart to them. They incrementally came to that knowledge. It wasn't like, here you go, bam, you know, like Emerald when he's cooking something, bam, and they all have instantaneous knowledge. That didn't happen. We have to understand these were people. And with Mary, it's hard to get your head around if you're Mary, how can I be giving birth to the Messiah of Israel, who's a man God? How can that be?
Yeah, plus the follow-up, walking, going on a donkey, giving birth in a,
mm-hmm.
in a barn-like setting.
Right.
How can you compare and say that this is royalty, heavenly
right.
royalty? That's hard to reconcile.
Right. Well, again, that idea of a barn setting, though, is another thing that we have wrong. Because if we're, there was no room for them in the inn,
mm-hmm.
is that literally means in the,
it's the same word translated everywhere else as upper room in the King James. And to be in an upper room, they would go to a family member's house. And if they had an upper room, it meant it was a large house of somebody who was pretty affluent. And typically they would put up their relatives, but because of the census, they didn't have room because there were too many other relatives up there. So they had to stay. What they had is off the living room, they had a room that would have a couple of steps down into it, and that's where the farm animals would be.
Yeah, that's, I've heard that.
Yeah, and literally the manger,
the feeding trough,
would really be kind of on a ledge.
It's just both nice throughout the Christmas tree.
It does.
You see the barn with the three wise men and everybody else.
And the wise men, obviously, they didn't come until 2 years later, but...
It looks nice.
It does look nice. But,
no.
But the whole point I think we have to understand is when Jesus began his ministry, he really and truly began his ministry where he was fighting an uphill battle with everybody. Because nobody fully embraced who he was. Where you find people beginning to really embrace him are a few people here or there who have experienced, and they are very few. Even Nicodemus, right? The first time you're introduced to him in John chapter 3, he's coming at night because he doesn't even want to be seen with Jesus. He's coming by secret of night to discuss some things with him because he has a curiosity about him. Then later on you read of him, I think it's in chapter 7 or 8 of John again, where he's a little bit more bold, a little bit more friendly to Jesus, and it's not until the crucifixion where he's willing to come out and stand for him. And it's after he's already been crucified.
Well, you know, John the Baptist being a forerunner, he was unique in his whole demeanor. Mm-hmm. So people would look at him and say, oh, look at him, he's different. People will follow that. Jesus was just a guy. And he says, well, what's the big deal here? You know?
He was a unique person, but there was nothing outstanding about him. I mean, no form of comeliness.
No.
And nothing.
Even though they were looking maybe for somebody that was more like John the Baptist, and he wasn't.
Right. Or somebody, big and powerful. But he didn't come across that way either. Rather than coming with a sword, he came offering peace. You know, rather than destroying Rome, he came with the idea of love your enemies. So they had a hard time following all of that and embracing that. So when Mark says in chapter 9, verse 19, how long, there's a certain degree of frustration there, but there's also that loneliness and that feeling that comes with that, that nobody can really quite understand what I'm trying to communicate, and nobody quite gets what it is I'm trying to do or say, and there's that frustration, but there's also that despair that's there. And when he says, how long must I have patience with you? He's had his entire life with them. And I think that's something that we oftentimes don't think about when we read these things. But I do believe it's important for us to understand that. So back in Mark 9, I want to finish with this idea here. Mark 9. And we'll start at verse 17. And we can kind of read around the room through verse, let's go to verse 27.
And one out of the crowd answered him, Teacher, I bring my son to you having a dumb spirit.
Whatever seizes him and throws him down, and he foams at the mouth, grains his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to expel it, but they were not able.
He answered him and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer you? Bring him unto me. They brought him to him, and when he saw him, straightway the spirit tore him, and he fell on the ground and swallowed foaming.
Then he asked the father, how long has he been like this?
From childhood, he answered, and often it has thrown him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you are able to do anything, have compassion on us and help us.
Then Jesus said to him, if you are able, all things are possible for the one who believes.
Straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help you, my unbelief. Jesus saw that the people came running together. He rebuked the foul spirit, saying to him, you dumb and deaf spirit, I charge you, come out of him and enter no more into him.
And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he is dead.
But Jesus, taking him by the hand, raised him up, and he was perfectly recovered.
So we have this account that comes upon this statement. The issue, the King James uses the word faith there. This uses unbelieving. They don't believe. They don't have faith. And Jesus says, well, how long do I have to put up with you? He's exasperated. And again, part of his exasperation is because the apostles or his disciples have been asked to expel it and weren't able to. Okay? We forget that point, which is the end point of verse 18. Then they bring this boy to him, right? And he asks the father a couple of questions. And it's interesting, verse 23. Could somebody read that in the King James?
Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him that believes.
Okay, if you can believe. Now, the word believe is only in a very few manuscripts. It's one that the writers in the King James used and put in. I don't think it should be there. Jesus said to him, if you are able, all things are possible for the one who believes. I think here, if you can believe, it makes it sound like Jesus is talking directly back to the Father. I think he's actually talking directly back to the disciples. And it's like, if you are able. In other words, the lack of faith is whose?
Yes.
The disciples.
Yeah.
And then he says, all things are possible for the one who believes. The Father cries out, I believe. Help my unbelief. But Jesus already knows he believes. That's why he's going to perform this miracle, because the man believes. Coming down a little bit further, notice here in verse 28, after the return of Jesus to the house, his disciples asked him privately, how is it that we could not expel the spirit? He told them, this kind can come out only by prayer. King James will add, and fasting. And again, that shouldn't be there. There's a lot of reasons why. It's only in a couple of manuscripts. The overwhelming majority don't have that phrase. But again, because it was such an integral part of the Episcopalian Church, that was a passage that would be...
Yeah, for fasting was an integral part of their faith, so...
Right, they added it in. It was part of the rules of translation given to the King James translators.
Why didn't they italicize it?
Because it is in two manuscripts. So they can justify it and say, well, we have manuscript evidence for it. But it's not in over 4,000 plus manuscripts. But the whole point is they failed to act in faith. They've tried to do it on their own power. That's why he brings up the idea of prayer. He prayed before he even selected them, and he's God. And he prayed about it.
Is this thing more common that they wouldn't be afraid of Jesus kind of thing? I mean, if you saw this happening
today,
it
would
freak
you out, wouldn't it?
Oh, my goodness.
It was common, and Israel was overrun by Satan's cohorts. And especially once Jesus came on the scene, it became more prevalent. Only because, if think about it, if you're Satan and you see your enemy in the land that he's said all along that he's going to become king of, it means that there's a battle probably going to take place there, so you're going to bring all your forces to bear there. And I think that's why we read of it like that. So, but you had that, and you have that discussion that takes place. Then it's interesting. Notice verse 31. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be surrendered into the hands of men. They will murder him, and after being murdered in 3 days, he will rise to life again. So as early as Mark 9, we have a passage that's explaining to them what's going to transpire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's significant because this, what we saw as early as Mark 3 in the book of Mark was when Jesus' ministry was already rejected. Because that's Matthew 12 that would coincide with. So it's you know, when we think about that, almost the entire book of Mark is written from the perspective that the nation is against him. And even those that are with him are only with him half-heartedly. They're not sold out. And you know, I think we have to understand there is that element here of this servant who's working tirelessly, and his work is not being appreciated. And I
it's
think
not being responded to.
Not
either.
Being responded to. It's frustrating for him. Yeah. So, but any questions on that? Is it anything you had ever maybe thought of or looked at before or considered?
Well, it's just human nature that's playing here. I think the religion of the world sees Jesus and God in stained glass windows and these Aldines, the old, and they've got this kid, he's otherworldly and he's not like a guy. He's a guy.
But he is a man, yeah.
I mean, they don't see him as, you know, it could be somebody walking, could be John, it could be Cindy, it could be Rick, it could be you.
Right.
He was an ordinary man.
Right.
You know, and they just, they can't be, you know. So they're used to living in an environment where Rome had all these gods that didn't really believe in them, but they had them because it was a moneymaker.
Right.
You know, so they had to, you know, they were looking for something like that because that's their environment.
It is.
You know.
It's well said.
The other thing I compare it was a study that we did a while ago, and we determined, well, what was it that made Jesus so, what was the hardest part of his ministry? The lack of gratitude. And so you have a two-pronged effect against him. Of not only did his disciples not get it, but the people that he served, only one in 10 were really grateful. The rest of them just ate him up and disregarded him after they got what they wanted out of him.
Right.
That's so prevalent.
It's sad when you think about it.
Now, what was it that you said I didn't get a chance to write the second point down? The first one, after how long must I be with you, is their faith is progressing.
Right.
And then I, how long is I had patience with you?
Right.
Is
let me just go back. I actually have it in a footnote here.
Oh, yeah, it is.
It really deals with the idea of His frustration that his presence with them had not resulted in greater faith is the first one. And the second point is it reveals the heavy burden that their unbelief placed upon him. So it's unloading his burden, so to speak, just verbalizing his frustration and the burden that he feels.
And it really doesn't say anywhere that Jesus taught his mother.
No, it doesn't.
Even privately.
Doesn't say it. And the closest you could come to saying that he taught her is probably in Acts chapter 1. Because we know that he appeared to about 120, and there's a lot of women with them. And she's one of the women that are recorded in the upper room. And that's the last time we read of her in Scripture.
We have Mary Magdalene Scripture either. They kind of fall off the pages of the Bible.
Right at that point. But I think it's partly because there's a shift in what's transpiring. I'm sure they were... If they're in the upper room, I'm sure they're still there. Yeah, they're active. They're just not recorded for us. But
very interesting.
Very good. Any questions from Ohio?
No. Very, very interesting again, though. Yeah, I never thought about Mary in that light before. But that makes sense, what he's saying. You know, that his family, his mother and brothers are those who are, you know, hearing him and in the spirit, not so much the flesh and blood. You know, that makes sense, that his family, biological family, was rejecting him. I knew the brothers were because they wanted him to go to Judea earlier so he'd be killed.
Right.
And but I never thought that much about Mary. So this was a lot of insight on that. Well, thanks.
Good. So I guess we'll call it a wrap. We'll be next Thursday then.
Tuesday,
Ohio, for next one.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Well,
good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Would you like to go to some?